This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The illegal trafficking in wildlife rakes in $20 billion a year. It's the third most lucrative criminal trade in the world, following drugs and human trafficking and ranking above arms smuggling. And while the profits for poachers and traders can be huge, the risk is very low. Law enforcement is limited by size and funding, and punishment is often negligible. Increasingly, signs point to organized crime groups and possibly militant terrorists getting involved in the business. Think this is all happening far, far away from us here in the Northeast? Well, think again. Bear bile, which can be sold for hundreds of dollars and used in traditional Chinese medicine, could come from Vermont black bears. In fact, selling the gallbladder and its bile here is legal. Exotic pets have been found all over the state, and if they were not bred in captivity, that's illegal. Not to mention collectors who might be interested in an ivory figurine, a traditional Native American headdress, or a chatouche shawl, all of which can get traders and collectors in trouble, depending on where and what these artifacts came from. But those are often the big questions. Where did these animals come from, and what animals are they anyway? Is that bear bile or pig bile? A harpy eagle feather or a crested eagle feather? A protected shiru antelope woven from that shawl or a cashmere goat? And that's where the world's first wildlife forensic lab, a CSI for animal trafficking, comes into play. Our guest today has just written a book about the lab and some of the cases it tackles. Laurel Nemi lives in Shelburne. Her book is called Animal Investigators, How the World's First Wildlife Forensics Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species. She joins me now in the studio. Hi, Laurel.
Hi, thank you.
Okay, Laurel, some of the examples of the kind of trafficking we're talking about here. I mentioned some. Others are caviar, illegally or legally harvested. Bear bile used for medicine, we talked about. Rare reptiles made into boots, belts, and purses. Walruses being slaughtered for their tusks. Can you explain why, for these animals or for a tiger, they're worth more dead than alive?
The animals are used in a lot of different products, both for food and as a delicacy. People want to collect the animals. They're used in medicines. And practically each species has some purpose or some reason that people will want it. And I'm constantly surprised at the extent of the trade. And, you know, everything from rhino horn to pet birds. Rhino horn is used both in traditional medicine, but it's also used in daggers in the Middle East for dagger handles. Almost every part of a tiger is used, the whiskers for talismans and the bones in medicine. And the list goes on for the number of products and the number of species.
For something like a tiger, you mentioned that almost every part of the tiger can be used, but often for an animal that's being trafficked, it's one part that's worth more than others. For bears, it might be the gallbladder, and then the bear is just slaughtered and the gallbladder is taken and the rest of the bear is wasted. Is that one of the major problems in animal trafficking?
That is a problem. And in fact, a lot of the cases are initiated from hunters themselves who see this waste when they're out and they hate it. In Animal Investigators, one of the cases I looked at was on hundreds of headless walrus, which were washing up on the shores of Northwest Alaska. And traditionally, every part of the walrus is used, the meat for food, the intestines for raincoats, the hide for boats, and the ivory, too, is used for tools, and it's always been used as a source of money or exchange. And so when people were seeing these walrus wasted, you know, just headless on the beach, slaughtered just for their tusks, they really hated it, and they believe that the walrus gifts itself to the hunter of their choosing, and that act is really an act of sharing and rebirth. So if you don't respect the animals, they believe that they'd go away. So to see this, they really believe that the animals could go away, you know, headhunted to extinction by the very people who depend on them.
This example in your book of the walrus brings up one of the more complicated issues in animal trafficking, which is that rules are different in different parts of the world and for different people. It's not illegal for native people in Alaska to hunt walrus, and it's not illegal to sell those parts. But if you waste the walrus, if you just take the tusks for the ivory, that's illegal. Can you explain a little bit so we can get a little bit of a handle on wildlife protection laws? I know the first one in the U.S. was passed in 1900, the Lacey Act.
Correct. And there's animals are protected at both the international level, the national level, and the state level. And the laws are extremely complicated. Typically, they're all based on species. And at the international level, there's the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species. And within that, there are three levels of protection for species that are listed. You know, there's prohibitions on commercial trade. There's allowing some trade, commercial trade. And then there's allowing permitted trade only in particular countries. So it has different levels of protection at the international level. To enforce that treaty, here in the United States, there's the Endangered Species Act, the Lacey Act, and a number of other different species-specific protection acts like the Migratory Bird Trade Act and Treaty Act, sorry. And the several things come into play. One is the species that's protected. Another thing is the date at which the law was enacted, because if it's sold prior to the date of enactment, it's legal. If it's sold after, it's not. And also permits come into play, because a lot of them are legal with a permit.
So it's a complicated law here we're talking about. And you mentioned CITES. This is what they call the Magna Carta of animal protection. And this was passed in the 70s, at the beginning of the 70s. Now there are 174 countries that have signed on.
Correct. Actually, another just signed. It's 175 today.
Who signed today?
So not today, but just recently. So it's expanding all the time, the treaty is expanding all the time. Because if you're not a signatory, then you're not bound by its rules. But even if you are a signatory, you may not have the national law to enforce it. So you can still be a signatory and not have the law. And even if you have the law, you might not have the enforcement capability to enforce the law that's written in your country.
All right, so we've clearly established that wildlife protection laws are complicated and they cross boundaries. One of the ways to ensure enforcement is to have undeniable proof that an animal part is from an illegally collected animal, or that this was collected more recently than the treaties would allow. So let's talk about this lab in Ashland, Oregon that you write about. This is the first and I think the only forensics lab dedicated to animal forensics?
That's correct. It's the only dedicated wildlife crime lab in the world.
And what's it like? You've been there. What's it like inside?
Well, in some sense, it's very nondescript for what it does. You know, it's a very nondescript building. And when you go in, you know, this evidence is locked up. There's a strict chain of custody. They follow strict protocols for making sure that they can track where a piece of evidence goes and who's handled it. And each of the labs has a different look. It almost looks like a science lab at a high school, at any high school.
Can you tell us, just give us a couple of quick examples of some of the cases they've worked on in this lab that have resulted in punishment or in enforcement of these wildlife protection acts?
Well, there's hundreds to choose from, but I'll describe, you know, it's interesting because perhaps one of the easiest to describe is a case in Animal Investigators that I look at that was trafficking Brazilian Amazon feather art. And traditionally, Amazon Indians would make these headdresses for the rituals and ceremonies, and they would not necessarily kill the bird. They would kill some for food and use the feathers. They would keep some as pets and use the molted feathers. And sometimes they'd capture them and then pluck the feathers and release them. But once U.S. and European collectors saw these beautiful, you know, feathered artifacts, they really wanted to possess them and hang them on their wall. And that really started this underground industry where people started killing the animals for these authentic Indian handicrafts. And sometimes the handicrafts were authentic, but sometimes it was others getting in on the game and buying these feathers and teeth and then making it themselves.
And in the book, you talk about this case because the lab had to get involved because these headdresses were being sold to a collector in the U.S. or a trader in the U.S. who then was selling on to other collectors. And the investigators, the law enforcement, needed to know if these feathers were from protected macaws and protected harpy eagles or not. And so how do they figure this out at the lab? How do they find out without a doubt whether it's a harpy eagle or a crested eagle?
Well, with difficulty. I mean, when you have just a piece of an animal, all the things that tell you that this is, you know, harpy eagle simply aren't there. If you're a bird watcher, then you have, when you're identifying birds, you have a lot to go on. If you think about it, you know, you look in the trees and you have the shape, the size, the plumage pattern. You can look at the flight pattern. You can listen to the vocalizations. You can watch what it eats. You have the habitat. So you have a lot of clues to go on. But the scientists at this lab have a single feather, or maybe hundreds of feathers that are woven into a headdress, all from different parts of the bird. Now, a bird has 5,000 feathers on average, and parts from one part of the same bird, like the tail or the wing, might have something unique about it, unique shape, unique color. Whereas a feather from another part of the bird, like the breast, might have nothing to identify it. And then you make it even more complicated because different birds within the same species also differ. So you think about juveniles and adults, how the feathers will differ, and males from females. And you can see what a complex task it is.
Why doesn't DNA work? I mean, you see all these ubiquitous crime dramas on TV, and it always seems like, oh, just take some DNA and you'll be able to figure it out.
And you're right. DNA is extremely powerful, and that's a great question. The problem is you actually have to have the DNA to compare it against. And one thing that's critical in every case at this lab is what they call reference specimens or standards. And to identify something, first you have to figure out what's unique about it. Then you have to make sure that what you figured out is unique, actually is unique, and is found in that species. So you have to compare it not only to all the bears. If you're finding a bile acid in bears, you have to make sure that bears have this bile acid. And to do that, you have to compare it to other organs of the same species. So same with birds. You'd have to compare this feather to other birds of that species to make sure you're right. And then you'd also have to compare it to other birds of different species. And so for DNA, it works the same way. And you would need a whole host of DNA specimens from known samples to be able to compare. And for the North American species, the lab has a pretty sizable collection. But for foreign species or for within certain classes like reptiles, the lab has a very much smaller sample collection.
You also talk about in the instance of bear bile that the bile doesn't have DNA because it's so, I believe, acidic that it breaks down the DNA. It's not there. So unless there's a piece of the liver attached to this bear bile, you can't take DNA. So you can't tell whether it's a bear or, as sometimes these hunters try to fake people out, they put in pig bile. And that's not illegal. So these scientists have to determine, first of all, whether it is bear bile or pig bile, and they have to find a way other than DNA to do that.
That's correct. And as these products get processed, a lot of the characteristics get lost. And so sometimes what gets lost is DNA, and sometimes it's the shape or size. If you think of a tooth, and you think of, okay, if an ivory tusk is attached to the elephant, you pretty much know what it is. But once it's removed and then carved, you lose the shape, you lose the size, you lose a lot of the characteristics that might tell you what happened.
And explain why that's another important example in your book, the difference between elephant ivory and mammoth ivory.
And well, in 1989, CITES, the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, passed an international ban on commercial trade in elephant ivory. And after that went into effect, there was a spate of smuggled shipments that was coming into this country where traffickers had shipments of ivory, and they insisted that the ivory was from mammoth, which are, ancient mastodons. which was legal, which actually is a little surprising, but truthfully, mammoth ivory is legal instead of modern elephants, which was not. And the customs had no way of telling otherwise. And without the ability to prove that these were actually an illegal product, they had to let the shipments go. And the lab was able to figure out a way to identify ivory from different species and identify and distinguish ivory from mammoth versus modern elephant ivory. And then with that, customs was able to stop the shipments and enforce this trade ban.
We're talking with Laurel Neamy about her book, Animal Investigators, and how forensic science is helping catch animal trafficking. And Laurel, you have a lot of examples in this book of other times when that has happened. These shawls made out of Tibetan antelope that are actually protected, and people were selling them sometimes as pashmina, as cashmere scarves, and the lab found a way to determine whether the guard hairs on these animals were from the goats, the cashmere goats, or from these Chiru antelope.
Right, and this is an interesting product because a lot of times with wool, you don't need to kill the animal. With this product, you did need to kill the animal, and it would take five endangered Tibetan antelopes to make one shawl, and the shawl could sell for as much as $15,000 to $20,000. And people love these things. They're called ring shawls, and because they're very warm but very thin, and so thin that you could put the whole thing through a wedding ring. And it's a very fine wool, very beautiful. And the problem is that once it's in the shawl, how do you tell the difference? And it took a while to figure out how to, you know, what to do. And that's what's interesting about this lab. For each species and for each product, the identifying characteristic might be different. In this case, it was the guard hair that was within the shawl. And for mammoth elephant ivory, it was an angle within the tooth that differed between mammoth and elephant ivory. And so for each species and each product, that characteristic is different, and it's this lab that's figuring out what that characteristic is.
So they're really breaking new ground on almost every case.
On almost every new case that involves a new species or a new kind of product.
How does the lab stay objective?
The lab, that's a great question, because one of the things that's so powerful about forensic science is its neutrality. When you see a show like CSI, it takes a few liberties, and in this lab, the investigators rarely are part of, the scientists are rarely part of the investigation. And in fact, they typically know very little about the investigation. When they receive a piece of evidence, they get the information about what the legal question is, because just like human forensics, wildlife forensics uses science to answer a legal question. So that's the question at hand that comes in on the evidence submittal form, you know, what you need to know. And 75% of the time, it's what species is it? And then with that, they need to know where it was found, perhaps, or things like that. But aside from that, they don't know a whole lot about the investigation. And in fact, that's what's interesting, because a lot of times while I was writing this book, you know, they simply didn't have any idea of the outcome of their case. You know, once it's out of their hands, it's out of their hands and out of their thoughts. They don't keep tabs on it. They really have no agenda one way or the other. And that's actually what makes it powerful.
You bring up an example of this in the book, again, to the bear bile, that traffickers are often passing off pig gallbladders as bear, and it's very difficult to tell. And investigators thought they had a slam dunk case against this trafficker who had what he said were over 180 bear gallbladders. The lab investigated, and they found that it was pig gallbladders, so they couldn't arrest this trafficker. And the lab, you know, to them, it's evidence is evidence, and if it's a pig, it's a pig.
Right, and it's in fact, what's interesting, when the director of the lab, Ken Goddard, was hired in 1979 to create the lab, it took about 10 years to actually establish the lab from there. But when he was hired, the two folks, the chief of law enforcement and a special agent who were interviewing him, asked him, would you, to help build support for the lab, we need to win a few cases, and would you be willing to just fudge the evidence a little bit so that we could win a few. And Ken Goddard walked out. I mean, he thought he didn't have the job. He's like, if I will report anyone who would ever ask me to do that. And he was furious and he walked out. Sure, he didn't get the job. And in fact, he did get the job. And that's what they were looking for, you know, just integrity above reproach. And it starts with him, but every person in that lab has that same characteristic.
Today, Shelburne author Laurel Neamey is with us. She's an international consultant specializing in natural resource management, and she's just written a book called Animal Investigators. It's about animal trafficking and the Wildlife Forensics Lab in Oregon that helps combat these crimes. And joining us now by phone is Colonel David LaCour, Director of Law Enforcement for the Vermont Department of Fish and Wildlife. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Jane. Thanks for having me.
You know, we were talking earlier with Laurel about bear bile and the sale of their gallbladders, and I understand that that's actually legal in Vermont. Can you explain the law?
It is legal. Many states have banned it. They were having problems with commercialization, as Laurel mentioned earlier. We didn't experience that in Vermont. Although it is okay for people to sell them, it isn't okay if the animal was taken illegally. We view it more as if the animal's being harvested in a legal way and they can utilize as much of it, that being, in this case, the bile, then we're fine with it.
But are you finding that there are bears that are hunted and killed and the gallbladder is taken out, maybe the paws are taken for sale and the rest is just left? I mean, that could happen in Vermont, right?
It certainly could happen. We haven't experienced, I'm not saying it's never happened, it has on a very few occasions, but you're absolutely right, it could. But we haven't experienced that to any degree.
I'm wondering from both of you whether you think that we need more uniform laws. I mean, as David just mentioned, in Vermont, the sale of gallbladders is legal. In other states, it's not. There are different laws that cross state lines. You know, sometimes artifacts are legal if they're sold before a law was passed. Sometimes Native people are allowed to harvest animals that are otherwise protected by law and sell those products when other people aren't. Does it make it confusing not only for consumers, but for law enforcement to figure out what the actual laws are, David?
It certainly can, and it's also troublesome to enforce because it's up to us to prove that the animal is other than what it's being represented. So getting uniformity would be nice, but we also have to recognize in years ago, a lot of these things weren't protected and were mounted or displayed, and how do you deal with what's already existing?
What do you think, Laurel?
I mean, that's a great question because how do you deal with something already existing or that was, you know, purchased prior to the law and it is legal? And there are ways that this lab is trying to identify things, you know, date different things using carbon ratios is one way. And it's also trying to, again, we talked about earlier, the captive bred, say, pet birds or pet reptiles versus wild caught. And now some of the problem, like with reptile trade, about 17% of the pet reptile trade ends up being wild caught animals that are laundered through the legal pet trade. And how do you tell the difference? And the lab is doing a lot of different things. You know, DNA would be great, but there are other ways too, through isotope analysis and different mechanisms to try and figure that out.
Peggy is calling from Morrisville. Hi, Peggy.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
I just wanted to say that as a professional wildlife biologist, I have worked with the Ashland Lab on endangered species within North America, wolf and lynx issues. But I just quickly that one of the things that people were so frustrated in my neck of the woods or in my work was that they see CSI and they think, oh, they can get the DNA overnight. You're working at Ashland. It would be lucky if we got a DNA result back on, you know, illegal poaching or an animal that was shot to thought to be a wolf within a year. So, and I don't know if Laura experienced that way. She was at the lab that it does take a lot longer working with wildlife species in one lab in the world doing this than the television shows seem to make us believe that they can get a DNA result just instantaneously, basically.
Peggy, is that because there's a backlog or because it takes more time for some reason?
I believe it's a total backlog because this lab is working on not only all the issues that Laura's been talking about, but you know, all the issues across, you know, the North America, particularly with our U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And so it's, and the way they do with wolves and lynx now is a DNA testing, and from what I understand, they have to set up the whole series to do it. So they wait till they get a number of animals, and then they can run it faster that way. That I'm not sure. I've heard that from other labs who do DNA on the canid species, but I think they're just backlogged.
Well, Peggy, thank you very much for calling in, for sharing your experience with us. And there is a case in the book, the walrus case that we talked about with their tusks. It wasn't because of DNA, but it took years for them to figure out what was going on with these walrus. David LaCour, I want to ask you, have you ever worked with the lab in Oregon?
We have. And as Peggy correctly pointed out, they are certainly backlogged greatly, especially now. When they first opened, we used them quite often, in particular with DNA, but also with the firearms, the ballistic tests, and so on. In recent times, because in the criminal world, we need results quicker, we haven't used them as much as we did, although they were a fantastic lab.
I understand you actually worked with them once on a case of turkey feathers. What was that case about?
Well, it's funny. I heard Laura talk about feathers previously. One of my own cases, I had an investigation of somebody saw a person, what they believe, shoot and harvest a wild turkey out of season. And all I had, I didn't have the body of the animal. All I had was feathers. And I was able to send those feathers out to the lab, and I knew who the suspect was, and I'd interviewed him, and he told me it wasn't a wild turkey, it was a domestic bronze, which looks fairly similar, especially if seen from a distance. So I had these feathers, but I couldn't say positively that they were wild turkey feathers, and I sent them out to the lab, and they determined that, in fact, it was wild turkey feathers, and not only that, they told me where on the body the feathers had originated. So it was very good, and I was able to make the prosecution based on that.
David, just last month in New York, the state announced that they'd uncovered a smuggling ring trafficking in turtles, snakes, salamanders. And the State Department of Environmental Conservation had launched the undercover investigation. It was called Operation Shell Shock, just to find out if anyone was commercially exploiting these species. We have the same species in Vermont. Do we need to start an operation like that and really see what's going on in this state?
That's a good question. We aren't aware of any large-scale operations like they undercovered or undiscovered, but we certainly have had on a smaller scale the same thing, in particular with the reptiles and amphibians. And usually it's an issue in the pet trade. That's what we're seeing, and that's the biggest threat in Vermont that we're aware of. To what degree it exists, we aren't aware of any significance right now.
But could that be just because you're not investigating it?
It could be. I'd like to think otherwise.
Laura, what do you think? I mean, I know that there are issues certainly with funding, with resources. Do we need to be doing more in this country to track down and really combat trafficking?
I mean, I think we do. I think Vermont is lucky because it's relatively well populated, and I think hunters pick up on things that are happening and people pick up on things that are happening. I think in New York you have much wider, open, wilder spaces where people simply just aren't, and so in some sense it's easier, and there are major trafficking hubs through the airports and ports in New York. But I think in general, more needs to be done. I think law enforcement, wildlife law enforcement, is very underfunded and understaffed. You know, there are, at the federal level, 200 odd special agents investigating this, and you compare that to the Drug Enforcement Administration with 5,000 and the FBI with about 12,000 agents, and it's just a very small proportion of law enforcement that's working on this.
David LaCour, what about punishment? I mean, you can see when you start to look into the crimes that have been prosecuted that there are inconsistencies with the sentencing, and often it's just very light. You get maybe community service, maybe a small fine, and it really doesn't dig into the profits that these traffickers can make. Do you think we need to have tougher sentences?
When it comes to commercialization, yes, I do. Our laws or our punishment is generally set up on an individual animal basis, thinking back to toward game animals when someone may harvest over their limit or something. It's not so much geared to punishing someone who has a tremendous financial gain for violating the law. So, yes, our penalties are very, very mild compared to the risk benefit is way out of whack as far as even if they get caught. It'd be a small price to pay.
Colonel David LaCour is the Director of Law Enforcement for the Vermont Department of Fish and Wildlife. David, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And Laurel, before we let you go, I'm wondering if people who are listening can know, is there anything they can do to make sure that their handbag, their shawl, their belt is legal? Or is it really people who are doing this on purpose that we need to be on the lookout for?
Well, the large-scale commercialization is the big problem. But that also comes because people are demanding it. And a lot of times people are unsuspecting of what they're buying. And there are lists of products to avoid. In fact, I've taken the Fish and Wildlife Service Tips for Travelers and adapted that. It's on my website, animalinvestigators.com, and people can go to that and also see a number of organizations, including, you know, state game agencies and the federal agency, as well as environmental organizations who are working on this issue. But I think more awareness will help a lot.
Well, this book will certainly give you more awareness. It's called Animal Investigators, How the World's First Wildlife Forensic Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species. It's by Laurel Nimi, who lives in Shelburne. Laurel, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.